listening and welcome to Health Matters, the Mental Health Edition. I'm your host, Dr. Shelley Visconti, licensed psychologist, counselor, and marriage and family therapist. Tonight, we will explore healthy and successful weight management. I invite our listeners to call with your question or comment at 1-800-552-8502. This evening, we have as our guest, Karen Rice. She is a licensed counselor and a bariatric counselor, CEO of Bariatric Counseling Solutions, and also she's in private practice at Richards, Cassio, and Rice. Welcome, Karen.
Thank you.
So, Karen, tell us a little bit about what you do, and you wear a lot of different hats, so tell us all about it.
Okay. Starting in the beginning, I was born in Texas, raised in Louisiana, and I've spent most of my career in social services, primarily working in one capacity or another with the seriously mentally ill population. In 2015, I decided it was time to reach out in another direction. And with the help of my spouse and my mentor, Anthony Williams, I formed Bariatric Counseling Solutions with the goal of providing counseling to people with weight issues.
So, and you sent me some information before the program this evening, and one thing, unfortunately, that wasn't too surprising is that our area, actually, we have a pretty high obesity rate.
That's absolutely the truth, only beaten out by, unfortunately, Little Rock, Arkansas.
So, and you're finding that there is a new trend actually among people that are contacting you possibly about, with questions about bariatric surgery.
Yes, that's true. In the beginning, I was seeing more morbidly obese or super morbidly obese patients who were seeking surgery. And now, sometimes when people walk through the door, I'm wondering if they're actually there for a surgical assessment or not. So it's people with barely meeting the criteria in terms of appearance, and even when they mention to me, you know, how much weight they want to lose or what their current weight is, it's not what I saw in the beginning.
So do you think this is because more people have access to the internet, more information? Any idea of why that trend is?
I think that is a part of it. I think that we're also more health conscious. I think that we're also more educated about the comorbidities, the hypertension, the hypercholesterolemia, all of those issues that spell disaster if they're not resolved.
Yeah, and then also some of the mental health issues that can come along with unhealthy levels of weight. You know, depression and other mental health issues are correlated with obesity.
Absolutely.
So what about getting information from the internet? Are there particular sites that are reliable and any sites that are not terribly reliable?
Nothing really comes to mind specifically. What I would suggest is to listen carefully if you're listening to a physician that has done bariatric surgery. It's important that you filter through the information that you receive, find out if that fits what you already know and what you've already researched. And I would continue to be a little skeptical. At one point or another, there may be something that comes up that may be a flag for you in terms of possibly deciding that that is not someone that you'd like to follow.
And so you counsel people who are considering bariatric surgery. You do bariatric assessments, but then you also do general counseling, and then also people who are just wanting to maybe get some information about healthy weight management. Would you talk a little bit about the kind of populations that you see?
I think at one time we even described them as the worried well, and that could be anyone who has concerns about their health and their future health. If there is issues that have arisen in their annual physical, or if they're finding that things that they're attempting, such as playing with their children or their grandchildren, and those things are not as easy as they were for them at one time, that may be someone who would come to counseling and try to work through some issues as far as not getting to the point of someone I might see that would fall into the morbidly obese category.
And I want to talk more about healthy dieting and just healthy weight management. I know we try not to use the word diet anymore, more of a lifestyle change. But I want to invite our listeners also to call in with their questions and comments. The number is 1-800-552-8502. Before we start talking about weight management, I want to talk a little bit about eating disorders.
Okay.
So, you know, people overeat. It happens. If we overeat, does that mean that we have an eating disorder?
Not necessarily. There is clinical criteria that we have decided. It's fairly new, I would say within the last year, year and a half, maybe a little bit longer than that. There is clinical criteria that is determinant of if we're discussing binging, if we're discussing nighttime eating syndrome. Those are the two mostly that I deal with when I do pre-surgical assessments. So I'm most familiar with those. So no, the fact that we all have a tendency at one point or another in our lifetime, whether it's at the Revel or Thanksgiving, we all have the ability to overeat. So no, that definitely does not meet diagnostic criteria.
So you mentioned binging, you mentioned nighttime eating disorder. Any other types of eating disorders?
There are several different types. These are the most that I'm most familiar with. Of course, there's anorexia, bulimia, and that's really, in my mind, on the other end of the spectrum. The ones that I'm discussing are the overuse of food, and anorexia, bulimia, to some degree, are more the lesser ingestion of food.
Would you mind talking a little bit about nighttime eating disorder? I don't know much about it, and I'm sure that our listeners would love to hear a little bit about what exactly that is.
At one time, there was some discussion about people who got up in the middle of the night, and we believed at one time that they were sleepwalking, and they might walk into the kitchen after they arise in the morning and find that there's an empty package of Oreos and not really know how that happened. There was also some discussion. As soon as the nighttime drug Ambien came onto the market, there was some discussion about people eating even full meals and not having the ability to recall that they did that. So basically what nighttime eating syndrome is, and when I am assessing whether a patient is in that category or not, my questions would be somewhat like, after you go to sleep, is there ever a time that, and I'm not talking about going to the restroom and stopping by the kitchen and getting a drink of water or a glass of tea or a sip of tea. I'm talking about going to the kitchen and fixing a sandwich, or I've even had people tell me that they would cook. So there's a difference between going to the kitchen and eating something or drinking something and returning right back to bed versus the person who might go in and fix a sandwich. Mm-hmm. So that qualifies for a nighttime eating disorder.
Mm-hmm. And so is this something that would happen pretty frequently, or is if we do it a few times, or is there particular criteria as to how frequently this occurs?
There is criteria. The interesting part is the frequency does not enter into the diagnostic part of it. It has more to do with the inability or the ability to control the behavior. Can the patient or can the person that we're dealing with, can they have control over whether or not they stop the behavior?
And just to let our listeners know, we're having a few technical issues. I apologize, and we are back on the air. We were off just very briefly, but I do want to remind everyone that we have tonight as our guest, Karen Rice, and we are talking about healthy and successful weight management. And I want to invite our listeners to call in with your question or comment at 1-800-552-8502. So also, we mentioned just a few minutes ago, binging. And we in the mental health field tend to think about binging a little differently than maybe the general public does. I know I hear people frequently talk about, well, I binged, and but we tend to have a little bit different criteria for that. Would you mind discussing that a little bit?
Sure. When people walk into my office for a pre-surgical assessment, if I ask the question before I preface it with a definition, I can ask the question, do you binge? Oh, yes, I do. And it's almost across the board. I would say there's a 95% chance when I ask that one question, the answer will be a positive response.
So people are endorsing it pretty frequently.
Yes, I'm almost beginning to think it's a thing where we describe binging, whether it's binging on buying magazines or it's binging on a box of Oreos. I'm kind of talking about Oreos a lot tonight. And I don't even like Oreos. So anyway, that's one of the things that I hear a good number of times is that people eat a lot of Oreos. interestingly enough, I think it may even be close to how we're expressing ourselves, but I find that clinically I get a better and more accurate response if I define what binging means. Binging is eating a vast amount of food in a very short period of time. And the issue really has more to do with Is the person feeling a sense of control, or are they out of control? And that is really the defining factor: does the person have the ability to control this?
So it's not just having an extra piece of cake or two, or instead of eating one sleeve of Girl Scout cookies, you eat both sleeves of Girl Scout cookies. We're talking that it's a tremendous amount of food, and the person really feels like they're not in control of this eating.
Exactly. That is a perfect explanation.
So if someone is engaging in these binging type behaviors, do you have any recommendations for them? Any particular treatments that are effective for helping treat eating disorders?
Well, we start looking at many things, and we try to deal with the issues of controlling it. We talk about where or when or what precipitated our first experience with true binging. Talk about family history and maybe how some of the behaviors that you might have experienced within your family context, how that affects it. And we really just deal with the behaviors that we want to try to extinguish. So it's much like most any other type of therapy that you do, we're just dealing with food. And we do the same typical things. We talk about keeping a journal, talking about feelings that are occurring. Was there something that occurred in that day? Was there something that occurred prior to the binge? And we just work through those kinds of things and develop alternative behaviors and different coping mechanisms so that the person does regain control and doesn't use food in a way that is so detrimental.
Do you notice any patterns, history of trauma, or poor coping skills? I know you mentioned coping skills, or is it just people come in with a variety of kind of backgrounds that may lead to an eating disorder?
I haven't really noticed anything that I could correlate with someone else. It seems like it's a variety. Again, most everybody admits to it, but when we actually get down to deciding, is this a person who binges, most often it's not.
Yeah, and I know I find that sometimes with panic attacks, people will come in and say, I'm having these panic attacks, and really when you go through the specific criteria with them, it's intense anxiety, but it may not necessarily meet the criteria for a panic attack. And so it sounds like that binging is similar, that people are maybe using the term in a different way than we as professionals might use it.
Exactly.
I want to invite our listeners to call in with your question or comment. The number is 1-800-552-8502. And this evening we have as our guest Karen Rice, and she is talking about healthy and successful weight management. So speaking of weight management, it's the first of the year, you know, the new year has just come around, and so I'm sure there's lots of people who their resolution is to lose weight. How do you know what type of weight management program is a good one? It seems like there are new, there's a better and new program coming out, you know, every week. How do you know what's going to work for you? How do you know what's valid and what's not valid?
I think that the biggest test, as far as something that I would recommend to a client, is to look at sustainability. Is whatever program that you're looking at, whatever diet that you're considering, whatever exercise program that you're considering, sustainability is the key. Is this something that I can continue on the long haul? Because part of the cycle of weight gain, weight loss, weight regain has to do with the fact that some of the choices that we make accomplish the short goal. We accomplish what we want to in terms of actually losing the weight. It's, can we keep it off? So I tell people who come into therapy, most any diet will work. If you reduce your intake and if you consider exercise in addition to that, you will lose weight. The test is, can you maintain the loss? And I have to say that as a whole, we are not terribly successful at that. And when you get into a cycle of losing, and regaining, you could end up 100 pounds overweight.
Mm. Yeah, I often find with clients, they will jump into a new health kick, and they, you know, say, well, I'm going to work out for an hour six times a week, and I'm going to cut my calories to this many, and it seems like a lot of times the expectations of themselves are unrealistic. And so I often will encourage them to, okay, but what is realistic? What do we know that you can do? Let's start there. You know, what is definitely accomplishable? So it sounds like that you have similar advice for the people that you speak with about, you know, what they can accomplish and maintain.
Exactly. And there needs to be, it doesn't need to be, we're grinding it out at the gym. There has to be some good stuff we put in there too. Some rewards, some attagirls or attaboys that we give ourselves if we have to, in terms of making it a positive experience and one that you can continue for the long haul.
Do you find that that I know that there are different Facebook pages or different internet sites and things like that that people can go to try to kind of seek support. Do you find those helpful? You know, having other people that you are trying to turn over a new leaf with?
Absolutely. In fact, for people that are just attempting, not involved in weight loss surgery, but just attempting healthy weight management, I think finding a buddy, and that can be someone that you find on the internet, probably not the best choice, but some people don't have a great pool of people to choose from. So that would be a second best or a third best choice. But I think that when you have a weight loss buddy, you have a diet or an exercise buddy, I think that is a fantastic way to share how you're feeling, what's going on, somebody to kind of pump you up a little bit when you think you should be losing weight and you're not. Also, I always encourage weight loss surgery patients to have an accountability partner. That's actually part of the pre-surgical assessment that I do. My question at the very end is, do you have an accountability partner? Now, I will say that I have met my first patient this past week who I felt truly did not need an accountability person. That was a patient who was very focused, very goal-directed, very self-correcting, and this particular person said he didn't need that, and I absolutely professionally agreed.
Yeah, and that is an unusual. I mean, I know personally, even, you know, when I try to, you know, reach goals, it's easier if I have somebody kind of helping me out, cheering me on, that sort of thing. And I know all the things that I'm supposed to do, all the right things I'm supposed to be telling myself to keep myself encouraged. So I want to invite our listeners to call in with your question or comment. We have as our guest Karen Rice, licensed professional counselor and bariatric counselor. And we are talking about healthy and successful weight management this evening. Talking about bariatric counseling, what is a bariatric counselor?
Well, it is a person who talks to people or counsels people about emotions, about how those emotions affect their eating habits. And I actually left a paper with you. I'm not sure you've had a chance to look at it or not, but honestly, bariatric counseling is not really about the food. It's about the emotions that we're trying to stuff, or emotions that we work hard not to feel or process. And in bariatric counseling, we talk about how eating and stress interplays. And I think that's something that anybody can relate to. You and I were talking before the show about the stress that is a part of our lives, so no one is immune. We talk about how food can be comforting. We talk about the fact that it's a stress reliever. It's a way to avoid feeling uncomfortable feelings. It's also a way we celebrate. And I hear that a lot from patients who talk about, oh, well, I'm from the South. I live down in the South. Food is everywhere in every situation, and they are 100% correct.
Yeah, you know, with food, we need food. It's not something if you're wanting to quit drinking or something like that, your body doesn't need alcohol, but your body needs food. And as you said, especially in the area of the country in which we live, it seems like food is a really integral part of everything we do. And so I can see how that would be really difficult for people who are having difficulty just managing their food intake, managing something that they need, they can't just avoid.
Right. And I think that using food outside of those parameters is part of what brings people to my office. It's out of the realm of using food for fuel. And with people that are not involved in weight loss surgery, the process, I tend to work with the non-bariatric patients, and that is the mantra. Food is fuel. That's all. Nothing more. We don't celebrate with it. We don't make ourselves feel better with it. We don't soothe with it. This is fuel, and get the best fuel you can get.
So it sounds like really changing your relationship, how you think about food, how you define food and its purpose in our life.
Absolutely. And I would also say, as far as bariatric surgery goes, that is one of the biggest things I think that surprises patients once they come out of the OR. They don't really, really realize that everything in their life, relationships, employment, everything changes as a result of surgery.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? How so?
It has to do with people's perceptions of the patient and what they believe about people who have weight issues. We can get into a little bit of the stereotyping, or people who have weight issues might be considered lazy. They may be the most accomplished employee in the world. They may be the most dedicated employee in the world, but they may not be the employee who will come in and ask for a raise.
I want to invite our listeners to call in with your question or comment. We have as our guest Karen Rice, and our topic this evening is healthy and successful weight management. So would you talk a little bit about what bariatric surgery is? What does that involve?
Basically, the short definition is bariatric surgery is a surgery that limits the amount or the volume of food that a person can take in at one time. So I think there is maybe a misconception about people who've had surgery. They can actually take in not the amount of food maybe that people who've not had surgery had, but depending on their choices, and this is one of the things that it's important to try to overcome if you are a weight loss surgery patient, you can take in enough food where you actually don't have as good response as you'd like, as good a surgical outcome as far as weight loss goes. So I'm careful to say that a person can take in a small amount of food at one time.
So even if someone has bariatric surgery, it does not guarantee that they will lose the weight and keep it off.
Absolutely. That is absolutely correct.
So it's more of an aid, a tool, but not necessarily a direct path.
Not a magic bullet, no ma'am.
Yeah. So psychologically, who would be a good candidate for bariatric surgery? What kind of mindset does someone need to be in before they have a procedure like this?
I think that the person who will do the best with surgery is the person who understands that there needs to be a definite and lasting change in their relationship with food. They have to be willing to acquiesce to some degree to the professional in their life, be it their nutritionist, be it their surgeon, and from time to time their counselor, who can advise them about what changes need to be made and to help them understand that some of the things that they're undergoing, some of the things that they're experiencing are not necessarily long-lasting or permanent, and the ways that they need to continue to try to grow and change with this tool.
So how does one go about changing their relationship with food?
It requires a great bit of insight, and I see people with varying degrees of the ability to do that. I try to reinforce pretty regularly that if a person who's had bariatric surgery does not change their responses in terms of how they used food prior to surgery. In other words, if you're taking the food away, which is basically what surgery does, what are you replacing that with? And that is the most difficult challenge post-operatively that I encounter.
Yeah, often I find that clients, I just won't do that anymore. No, we need to find a replacement behavior. We need to find a healthier way of coping, because that was a coping tool. And if we just take that away from you, then you're just going to go back to what you know. Do you find something similar?
Absolutely. And that also accounts for issues such as transfer addictions. If you don't replace the behavior that you've taken away, you're going to replace it with something. And that might be alcohol. So we're seeing a great increase in the amount of alcohol addiction that we see in bariatric patients. It might be shopping. It might be any other type of pleasurable activity that would replace what you got when you were eating a box of Girl Scout cookies.
And I think that people may or may not realize that, you know, eating can, it can be pleasurable. And because of that, it can be very addicting, just like alcohol or shopping or gambling or things like that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
I want to invite our listeners to call in with their questions or comments. Tonight we have Karen Rice on the program, and we are discussing healthy and successful weight management. The number is 1-800-552-8502. So a little while ago you were talking about, I want to kind of touch on this again, the cycle of losing weight, gaining weight, losing weight, gaining weight. Do you have any other tips for staying off that cycle? Because it sounds like it can be really detrimental in the long run of this kind of yo-yo dieting, as some people refer to it.
It's pretty much the reason that I suggest that you do find a buddy, you do find reliable internet sources. There could be physicians on the internet that you find have good, sound advice that you've put through your filter, through your own research about what works for you, what seems reasonable as far as a long-term solution. So you do have to filter through your own, you know, base of knowledge as far as what you come across on the internet. There's plenty of people on for doctors or experts on YouTube or any other. You can just punch it in Google and all kinds of people will come up. And that's just when you're surfing the internet, that would probably be something that I would recommend, especially since you can punch that button anytime that you're bored or you have nothing to do, that you might get an answer or you might see something or feel or notice something that you didn't know prior to listening to that. Again, accountability partner, I think, is the way to go. That's the person that you're not going to get mad if they tell you, Karen, why are you ordering that, or why are you eating that? And it can't be your spouse. I have to tell people all the time, you do not want to put them in the position to be the police. It's very hard on a marriage to go through any type of really large change, which is what weight loss surgery is, and to put your spouse through that is that's not fair.
Do you see weight loss surgery impacting relationships?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I would say that is probably the greatest impact in terms of marriage and long-term relationships. The research is bearing out that people where one spouse goes through weight loss surgery, the people that go into that procedure who have a good, strong marriage after weight loss surgery, the research is showing that their marriage does nothing but get better. The flip side is for people whose marriage may not be in the best place, it's very stressful, and it is possible that the marriage would not survive.
I invite our listeners to call in with your question or comment. The number is 1-800-552-8502. And this evening, we are talking about healthy and successful weight management. And a little earlier, you talked a little, you mentioned some of the stereotypes that are associated with being overweight. How do we battle those? How do you counsel your clients on dealing with some of those stereotypes and impacting their self-esteem?
For the patients that are willing, I talk about education. One of the ways I address that during a session is I talk about questions that people may be asked, particularly as it relates to why are you having weight loss surgery? And there's other issues also that are non-surgically involved, but that is the most obvious one. People will tell potential weight loss surgery candidates that they don't need the surgery, that it's dangerous, that it doesn't really work. And my response to them, or my coaching for them, is we really need to educate people about what weight loss surgery is, what it will do and what it won't do, and we need to educate people about how to respond to and treat people in terms of what the stereotype is about who people who are overweight are.
And you mentioned just a minute ago that going through the surgery can negatively impact a relationship that maybe isn't great to begin with. Are there other factors that might make someone not a good candidate for this type of surgery?
I see there are people who might agree with most of the parameters in terms of how life might change for them after surgery. And some of those people will tell me during assessment and maybe even counseling after that, I'll be willing to do everything my doctor says, except I'm not giving up Coke. So it's the people who have the deal breakers. And I don't want to give you the impression that it's an all or nothing, but you pretty much, the things that are identified that you have to change in your life, and I hesitate to even say things you have to give up, because you get so much more than you give up in terms of weight loss surgery. But there are deal breakers. And continuing to drink Coke, we have the evidence, we have the research. We know that weight loss surgery patients who continue to drink, it can be Diet Coke, it can be real Coke, it doesn't matter. It's Coca-Cola, period. There are people that just do not think that they have to follow all the rules. And so, unfortunately, we know that those are the people that we will probably see on the regain side.
Mm-hmm. I invite our listeners to call with your question or comment. This evening, we are discussing healthy and successful weight management. The number is 1-800-552-8502. So when you are performing a bariatric assessment, what is that? What do you do?
It is a pre-surgical assessment. It is actually underwritten. It's actually tested and evidence-based outcome assessment by the American Society for Metabolic and Bariatric Surgery. It's 12 domains. It actually takes about 2 hours to go through all 12 domains with the potential surgery client. It takes another 2 hours to write the report. It takes another 2 hours to get it to where it needs to go. So I have 6 hours invested every single time, but the surgery is so important. The answers are so important. It's actually a map for the surgical team. Pre and post, we're trying to identify all of the areas that might be potential challenges, and the surgical team can use that for an indefinite period of time to help the patient make it through to the successful outcomes. So it's questions and answers. Pretty simple and straightforward. We talk a little bit about the family history, about when the patient was first aware that they had weight issues. Most of them, actually, if I looked at percentage-wise, we're talking from early ages, third grade and on. I do hear from time to time that there are women who experience weight gain after the births of their children, and they never quite lose that weight, and it just, after the birth of each child, there's significant weight that's not lost. So that could easily, with 3 children at 20 pounds, that could easily turn into 60 pounds. So, yes, that is something that I see quite often.
And we have a caller, actually. Stuart, go right ahead with your comment or question.
Hey, good evening. Wanted to directly address the possibility of bariatric surgery for someone like me who's type 2 diabetic, does pretty good at exercise and, you know, somewhat good at food control, but there seems to be some evidence that it really has a marked difference on glucose control as well as insulin resistance, and I wondered if you could address that.
I have heard that there are some people who are diagnosed with type 2 diabetes who have that condition reversed. Certainly that's not something that the procedure promises or guarantees, but I would say that depending on specific circumstances, and I'm not medical, so I wouldn't be able to enumerate for you what those are, but I do know that that has occurred. I don't think there's enough long-range evidence to say whether that's sustainable over 25 or 30 years. We're still gathering that information. But I have heard of instances and patients who have reported that their diabetes did resolve.
So, and that's something that Stuart might be able to go to a bariatric surgeon and discuss further.
Absolutely.
Those particular concerns or questions and things like that. Thank you, Stuart, for your question. I invite our other listeners to call in this evening. We are discussing healthy and weight management, and I have as our guest, Ms. Karen Rice. Our number is 1-800-552-8502. You mentioned the 12 domains. What are those?
There's the first one, of course, is weight history. The second one is eating disorder symptoms. And I want to make a comment here. I was actually under a false assumption when I first started learning about eating disorders. It was my understanding that if any of these were potentially a part of the weight loss patient's history, that that would preclude them from surgery, and that is absolutely not the case. So I think that might be important and possibly even reduce a little anxiety as you sit for an assessment. Mm-hmm. There's a good bit of questions about mental health experience, any type of treatment. Again, those issues do not preclude you from surgery. Let's see. There are a good many. We talk about relationship issues. We talk about trauma. Could be sexual trauma or any other kind of trauma. That's pretty much the salient parts.
So, but if someone has, let's say, a mental health history or a history of eating disorder or relationship problems that are of concern, is that something that they could then work on? And then once they are maybe in a slightly better place, then move forward with the surgery?
That's absolutely the purpose of the assessment, is to identify those areas that might reduce the possible surgical outcome success. And so you want to make sure pre-surgically that those areas are identified, and then the assessor could make a recommendation about what needs to happen. And certainly counseling would be a part of that.
Yeah, so it wouldn't be that it would exclude the person from having the surgery. It may just be that these are some areas that need to be addressed before moving forward, just to make sure that the person is psychologically ready, because it sounds like being psychologically ready is incredibly important.
Oh, it is. It is. And finding out as much as you possibly can about the procedure, being able to verbalize that and verbalize your understanding of what's going to happen in that operating room, and understanding and accepting what may happen as a result of the surgery. Certainly, losing weight, feeling better, getting healthier, all those things are the things that we're after. But bariatric surgery is a lot more than that.
Yeah, I'm sure that people sometimes go into it with visions of rainbows and puppy dogs. and I'm sure that there are a lot of adjustments that have to be made that aren't all, that are really difficult.
There are, and there are some people that experience some genuine grief over the fact that they can't eat a Whataburger.
I want to invite our other listeners to call in at 1-800-552-8502. This evening, we are talking about healthy and successful weight management with Karen Rice. So we were discussing the bariatric assessment, and it's a pretty extensive assessment, the 12 domains that you go through with the client, and then a report is produced. Who orders this assessment? Who does the report go to? What happens with this information?
The surgeon lets the client, potential surgical client, know that this is a part of the process, much like a pre-surgical diet or meetings with nutritionist or documentation of the ability to lose a certain amount of weight depending on how much weight the person has to lose. The insurance company is the one, if there is in fact an insurance company involved, they're the ones that would like to look at this before they say yes or no in terms of approving the patient for payment. So the report would go back to the surgeon that's involved, and their staff would forward that to the insurance company for them to say yes or no.
And I'm sorry, we have Cheryl from Bossier. I believe that Cheryl was actually who I was looking for when I was trying to locate Brian. Cheryl, go right ahead with your question or comment.
Will surgeons consider this surgery for teenagers?
I am not aware that is available in Shreveport. When you say teenagers, do you mean 13, 14? Do you mean older?
15, 16, 17.
I would encourage whomever is looking at this to contact their surgeon of choice. I believe we have two in the Shreveport-Bossier area. We had three recently, and that may have already changed, but I am aware of two, and certainly a consultation or evaluation would be in order here. I have personally not done an assessment on someone that age. I know that in other cities they will do that, depending on the BMI and, you know, comorbidities, how if there are other issues medically with the person, they will consider it, but I could not speak for whether or not the surgeons here would agree to that.
So you mentioned BMI. What is that?
Body mass index, and that is the surgical standard in terms of can a person of this height at this weight be qualified for surgery.
So that's a calculation based on height, weight.
Yes.
And you're given a number.
Yes.
And then that is one of the determinants of whether you qualify for the surgery.
Absolutely. In addition to what comorbidities you may have. By that I mean, do you have hypertension? Do you have diabetes? Do you have other issues that might become more serious as time goes on that your weight would hinder you from trying to eradicate?
I want to invite our listeners to call in with your question or comment. We are talking about healthy and successful weight management with Karen Rice. The number is 1-800-552-8502. So we've been talking about bariatric surgery, but what if someone is not appropriate for surgery, or what if someone just doesn't want to have surgery? What other advice might you have for someone who is looking to reach a healthy weight, to maintain a healthy weight, but doesn't want to take the surgery option or just can't because of other reasons? What advice do you have for that person?
And I probably have actually not done a very good job tonight of putting out there that not everyone is appropriate for surgery, medically or psychologically. So I do want to say that I don't believe that surgery is the answer for everyone with a weight problem. And it's as far as advice for people who are not considering surgery, it's pretty much the standard in terms of what we can do, and it's what you've heard most of your life, probably, that drink your water, use food as fuel, try to figure out the psychological aspect of how you use food. Do you use food to reward yourself? Do you use food to soothe yourself? So you want to do those things in terms of either journaling, talking to a friend, going to a support group, anything that you can do to focus your attention in the present on the things that you'd like to change.
Do you find that some of these weight programs or meal plans or things like that are helpful, or do you find that that just complicates things?
I see quite a few people who have quite a history of those particular programs, and I certainly don't want to say anything negative, but I would ask you again to run this through the test of, is this something you can sustain? And I mean financially, mm-hmm. and I mean from the standpoint of, can you eat XYZ food for years to come? It will do what you want it to do. You will lose weight. But what happens when you stop the program? We all return to what we knew before that, almost without exception. So if that is the way that you choose to go, I certainly wouldn't want to discourage anybody from trying to get healthier and lose weight. But I would ask that they try to move forward with, what am I going to do when I no longer go to XYZ program? Mm-hmm.
So those types of programs can help, but it's important to really assess, can I sustain this for the long term? And that's really going to be the most important factor of what's going to lead to success, is sustainability, it sounds like.
Yes, ma'am.
So I want to invite our listeners to call in with your question or comment. The topic this evening is healthy and successful weight management. Our number is 1-800-552-8502. And we had some technical problems a little bit earlier, so I wanted to go back and talk about a few things that that listeners might not have had the opportunity to hear you speak on. So I wanted to talk again about eating disorders. And you had mentioned the syndrome where people would actually eat at night when they were sleeping. Would you mind describing that again for us?
Sure. Nighttime eating syndrome is after a person goes to sleep, presumably for the night. Many of us get up in the middle of the night to use the restroom or to get a drink of water. And at that time, it may be that they want to grab a handful of chips or a couple of cookies. That's not really nighttime eating syndrome, although it's not a good idea for lots of reasons. First of all, it's calories that you're not going to expend because you're going back to sleep. We have teeth issues and sugar issues and all sorts of things. It's not a good habit to get into. And we have even worked on some pretty creative things in therapy about putting cookies and chips and small cans of Cokes somewhere where you can't find them in the middle of the night. That's worked pretty well so far. So you just have to get creative with it sometimes. Mm-hmm. Nighttime eating is a disorder where you might not be coming fully awake, or you might be fully awake, but usually not as awake as you might be when you're cooking, you know, dinner or lunch or what have you. And people might eat an entire meal, so that might be the fourth meal of the day, and experiencing a loss of control over being able to stop that behavior. And it's pretty pervasive to have sleep issues. So are they bored? Are they sad? Are there things going on at the time that are not coming to the forefront? So that's the issues mm-hmm. that we deal with night eating syndrome.
And I can't say that I've had a lot of experience with it, but I have had some clients report behaviors like that to me before, and it seemed like that those type of behaviors would happen when they were under a particular amount of stress. When there were a lot of things going on or changes or things like that, that those behaviors tended to emerge.
That's exactly right.
We have Sheila from Shreveport. Go right ahead with your question or comment, Sheila.
The question about eating for energy. I was diagnosed with an underactive thyroid, so I need to know what sort of things that would help me not to look for that food for my energy.
Sheila, would you mind repeating yourself? We had a little bit of a difficulty hearing you.
I've been finding myself eating because I feel tired. I've been eating for energy. Something helped me when I just feel so hungry because I'm tired and I want to pick me up and try because I need to keep going. You know, trying to eat for energy.
Sheila, we're still having some problems hearing you. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put you on hold, and then I'm going to let you talk with our staff maybe and see if they can get a message to me and we can try to answer the question on air, because I want to try to answer your question, but we can't hear you. I want to invite our other listeners to call in with questions or comments. The number is 1-800-552-8502. And actually, Sheila, our producer, is sending me a message, and she says call back, and they will be happy to take your question, and then we will try to answer it on the air. I mean, I'm sorry, I will try to answer it on the air, but she will send the question to me. So, talking a little bit about eating disorders, how are eating disorders diagnosed?
There are specific criteria, a set of questions that, according to our DSM-5, that define these particular disorders, and we just run through the criteria like we do with any other type of diagnosis, depression, or any of the others. And it's just pretty much answering those questions in terms of what the client's reporting.
And what is the DSM-5?
Diagnostical and Statistical Manual that counselors and psychologists, psychiatrists, everyone uses in the community in terms of assigning a diagnosis.
Yeah, so it's this big, thick book that lists all these different possible mental disorders, and it has criteria that we in the mental health field essentially use to try to determine whether someone meets criteria or not for that disorder. And I think that we may have Sheila back on the line, maybe. Let me see if maybe we can hear her this time. Sheila, would you like to try again?
Yes, can you hear me better?
I can. Go ahead.
Great. I was diagnosed with that underactive thyroid, so I find myself eating for energy. And so because I feel tired, so I'm thinking that I need to eat. So I've been battling with that, trying to eat for the energy because I feel so tired. And I was trying to find out if you've had anybody or what could you recommend for that?
Well, my first question would be, when you are eating for energy, can you give me an idea of what type of food that you might be eating? Would it be a carbohydrate? Would it be a protein?
I just hadn't identified that yet, but because I am a busy person, I will stop and get what I will call the healthiest fast food I can find, something like that. But I just feel so hungry a lot, and when I think about when I feel that hungry, it's because it's probably like in the middle of the day when I've kind of wore myself down, but I got to keep going. So I was trying to find something that I could, you know, help manage that.
And I'm sorry, Karen, we are running short on time, but go ahead and answer the question, but we have a couple of minutes left just to let you know.
Okay, thanks. I would suggest that you look into the area of protein. I know that that's not as easily accessible as you might like, but one tip for you that we actually, we do think is a good suggestion is if you have a point in the week or in your weekend where you can prepare some things that you can grab and go because you are very busy, something you could stick in your pocket like a cheese stick, maybe a small package of nuts, something protein that would help keep your energy level from going up and down so that you don't feel like you have enough energy to be able to spend.
Thank you, Karen, so much for your expertise and spending time with us. Any last minute suggestions? We have just a minute left.
Just do your research. Use your filter to find out or to separate the fact from fiction. Avail yourself of every single thing at your disposal to help you reach your goal.
Thank you so much for being with us this evening, Karen Rice. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Mental Health Matters is a program for informational purposes only. For all mental health questions, please consult a mental health professional. The views and opinions expressed on Mental Health Matters do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Red River Radio, LSUS, or its employees. This show is available for download from redriverradio.org. Mental Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Production assistance has been provided this evening by Wally Derleth, Sheila Lawrence, Tim Snell, and Al Villarreal. Support for this program comes from the Knoll Foundation and also from the Community Foundation of North Louisiana, and a gift from Kit and Lisa Gamble. I'm Dr. Shelley Visconti. Thank you for joining us this evening.